for coming out. This is the kind of collaboration that WBUR loves to be involved with. I think one of the things we think about when we think about our mission is building community, and the Boston Book Festival is just one of the greatest ways to do that. So thank you for being here. And it gives me huge pleasure to introduce two authors who examined leadership, the qualities of great leadership, from two very different perspectives. Anthony Chan's book called Good People, The Only Leadership Decision That Really Matters. It comes at a great time because it reminds us that while new technology has made us more connected, transparent, more productive than ever, the new capabilities haven't necessarily produced great leadership. In fact, Anthony's going to argue that we're suffering from a real crisis in leadership, with public trust in corporations at low, trust in media low, trust in startups low. I would add, I think you would agree, trust in government low, at an all-time low.
Oh, no.
No, okay. So maybe I'm going out on a limb on that one, but we'll talk about it. So Anthony explores...
I don't think I have to argue that.
Okay, good. He explores the qualities of great leadership and the five things all good people have in common. So we're going to talk about that. Nancy Kane's book, Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times, goes back in history to find examples of great leadership. She examines the lives and skills of five leaders who overcame huge challenges to achieve their goals. British explorer Ernest Shackleton, President Abraham Lincoln, abolitionist Frederick Douglass, German pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and environmental writer Rachel Carlson. So what I'm going to do is spend a little time with Nancy, a little time with Anthony, and then hopefully sort of the three of us will sort of throw some ideas back and forth and then open it up to questions to all of you for the last 20 minutes or so. So think of some questions. There's the microphone. And I'll let you know when we start that part of the program. So, Nancy, let me start with you. Okay. It's a great group of people, and you argue that the principal quality that unites these five people is that they weren't born leaders. Right. They were sort of made leaders by crises, right?
They were made leaders, Anthony. They were made in the crucible of crisis. And they were made by a combination, if you will, a cookbook of a couple of things that any of us, and many of us in the room are old enough to have, with the mileage of our lives, to have known, right, what it's like to be at the center of a perfect storm of calamity. So you'll recognize this. The first thing they were made by, and this is the most interesting thing in some ways, is each of them, Lincoln, Rachel Carson, the environmentalist, who is what you don't know about Rachel Carson. You know she rocked the world in 1962 with the publication of Silent Spring. And for my millennials, the millennials in the group, never doubt that you can change the world, and that one person can make all the difference. Because this, she is your standard. She is your gauntlet. You will never forget her. So she is battling metastasizing breast cancer while she's trying to finish this book. So when you're in the middle of a crisis, you either decide, and sometimes it's implicit, sometimes it's explicit, you're going to get better and find something in the midst of the high waves and the big winds, the fast winds, that's going to redeem, a diamond in the rough, something you can learn about yourself. I'm not talking about a business opportunity. I'm not talking about, Rahm Emanuel, never waste a good crisis. I'm talking about the conversation with yourself, right? So that's the first thing. And they do, by hook or crook, they do. And because many of them deal with lots of crises, they get better and better and better at finding the diamonds. Second thing, they discover a worthy mission, the kind of mission you're talking about, Tony. You know, a mission of decency, a mission that moves the boulder of goodness forward, a mission about humanity. Third, and maybe this is in some ways the most relevant for our moment, although it's not that either of those things aren't pertinent. The third thing they discover is that their leadership actually starts within themselves and moves outward. Begin within. It's not, here's the toolbox I need, here's the template, here's the alphabet, here's the seven habits. It's not that. It begins within me. And so they were talking about leaders who wouldn't have used this language in the 19th century, but had great reserves of emotional awareness, and then figured out from that place how to motivate others, right? Because you're going to change the world, then you're going to build a community of people to help you do that, right? That's the crucible. And each of them have many of these moments, and they get better and better and better at putting those ingredients together.
So let's talk about one of them. I'd love to just ask you a little bit about Ernest Shackleton. I knew a little bit about him, but not a lot. I loved reading the section about it. And so briefly, as most of you in the room probably know, British polar explorer, tried to reach Antarctica. This was about 100 years ago, right? 1915, with his crew of 28 aboard the Endurance, which gets stuck in ice. He abandons ship. They watch the ship go down under the ice. He's got 28 people, two lifeboats, 1,000 miles from civilization on ice.
No text messages, no GPS.
On ice. Right. Right. So what's the problem?
Right. So what's the problem, right? So this is I started with this story. I had written a case. I'm a historian at the Harvard Business School. That's my W-2. And it was where this book was born. So the book is not, it's a storybook, but because it was born at HBS, it's about what can we use from these stories for today. So in the narratives, there are no bullet points. I don't do bullet points. I got tenure at the Harvard Business School 10 years, and I could put away sports statistics and bullet points at that point. And no bullet points, right? And so woven in these are all these interesting lessons. So Shackleton has this impossible task, like each of the people in this book, and the meaning of the book, I'm looking at my millennial, our millennial, the future, the meaning
There's
of the book.
There's a lot riding on your shoulders.
You're right,
here.
Sorry. You didn't know this. You were signing up for this. I'm sorry. But the meaning of the book is how do we make ourselves, ordinary people, capable of doing extraordinary things. So Shackleton's story is, I've got to change first. He paces the ice and says, how does a man change himself once the old mark has gone aground, has gone away. And so he shifts gears. I'm going to save him. With God as my witness, Scarlett O'Hara, I will get these guys home. And then it's a series of, as you know, it's a series, and Tony knows, they've been so generous as to read the story. It's a series of, like, these huge obstacles that keep coming in front of him or bumping up against him or falling in his path, and he has to keep surmounting them from how do I manage the energy of my men, because his worst enemy isn't starvation. That becomes important at the end. But his worst enemy is disillusionment and ennui and the men giving up and disuniting, right? Right, divisiveness. How do I manage the energy of men? How do I keep my own resolve strong? Because the interesting thing about all these people is inside, a lot of the time, they're at the edge of the chasm ready to, you know, what did Tommy Lee Jones say in The Fugitive? He did a diver. He did a Peter Pan right over the dam. Right, they're ready to do a Peter Pan right into the chasm of doubt. How do they keep themselves from the edge? And then last but not least, how do I kind of see the next possibility, right? Each of these people are navigating point to point. How do I see the next possibility and then get there, and at the same time not be so debilitated by the act of having overcome that obstacle that I can't find my muscles of moral courage and resilience again? So Tony talks about this in his book. You've seen this in leaders. You've studied, Anthony. Resilience and moral courage are muscles, right? We access them. And our character and our competence, right, are hugely determined by our access to those and our willingness to keep working on them. So Shackleton is the first story in the book because I wanted to grab an attention-challenged generation of people with lots of things competing for the time with the most dramatic story. You can't stop reading the story once you start it. And because he's a great example of these important aspects or lessons.
Let's talk just for a couple of minutes about another story, and that's Abraham Lincoln. And you write that by midsummer 1862, Lincoln's back was up against the wall. So the Civil War not going well for the Union. There'd been a string of Confederate victories. Union troops were in retreat. And you write, public morale plummeted. Newspapers and politicians assailed the president for incompetence. So he's facing a real crisis. So what traits of leadership did Lincoln have to summon as he faced the possible dissolution of the Union? Again, what was the problem?
So, well, just a wee problem. Just a little gnat's eyelash of a problem. What was this Lincoln whinging on about? Come on, get with it. So what Anthony and Tony don't know, and you don't know, is I actually set out to write a book about Lincoln, and then in a moment of humility and clarity, I realized 5 years in, the world did not need another book about Lincoln. Blessedly, I put that away, and so I worked very hard. Again, remember, I'm starting from the inside out. I'm starting from the idea that emotional awareness and the making of leaders is the story, and I'm not working deductively. I'm a historian. We're inductive. We're detectives. And so I'm working to find the kind of emotional experience of Lincoln. He is up against the wall. He doesn't know what to do about slavery. He's not yet the great emancipator. I argue that in the crisis of 1862, when the country is coming apart at the seams, and they can't figure out how to finance the war, much less get his Union generals to fight. Lincoln says, and he said this years later to the guy that came to paint the famous portrait of Lincoln reading the Emancipation Proclamation to his cabinet, Francis Carpenter. He said, I had almost run up out of cards, and I resolved to play the last one or lose the game. And so in that darkness, you know, and we know that Lincoln was very depressed and very, very anxious. We know what you don't know is he threatened to kill himself at least twice during the war. That's how close he got to the canyon and doing a Peter Pan. He didn't. The leader doesn't. The parent doesn't. The school principal doesn't. Right? The daughter caring for her elder mother doesn't. And in that is all the difference. Right? So he don't get it. But in that moment he said, there's got to be a way of reclaiming this extraordinary bloodshed. I'm gonna free the slaves. And he writes in secret over 3 weeks. He writes the Emancipation Proclamation, telling no one, locking it up in a desk at the War Department at night. And then once he has promulgated to his cabinet and announced it publicly after a very bloody Union victory at Antietam in the September of 1862, this is the really interesting thing, a very important lesson for our time and our president right now. He's put a lot of thought into this. Great emotional awareness, detachment, looking at it from all angles, consideration of the trade-offs, consideration that he's going to take a hit at the midterms. He has done all this. So once he commits to the once a leader commits to the to a thoughtful, serious decision, slowly, methodically, patiently, he holds the line. This turns out to be the most important aspect of Lincoln's presidency, the commitment he made to that document and what it meant to change the stakes of the war and transform the country. And he made it in crisis, and he made it within himself first.
One of the things that I loved about the Lincoln chapter is you remind us that he worked really hard. He studied military strategy. So here's the President of the United States sort of acknowledging, there's stuff I don't know, and I know what I don't know, and I'm going to try to make
pull
myself...
Pull the knowledge. Can we imagine? Can we entertain conjecture, as Shakespeare would say, that leaders pull knowledge? This story is... I write in the conclusion, one of the really gripping themes of the book, consistent threads, is how they educate themselves the way all of us have to ultimately educate ourselves. And it is on a need-to-know basis, but it's this pulling of knowledge. They're not stroking their lovers at their phones, right? They're pulling their knowledge.
Yeah.
Well, seriously, I worry about this. As a historian of leadership, that we're so busy stroking our lovers, we're missing what's happening as Rome burns, right? Okay. But he didn't have that. But
oh, look, I got a text.
So. Oh, yeah,
no,
there
sorry,
you go.
Sorry.
So this self-education piece in every single story here is really important, right? And it's again a gauntlet on the glove. It's a glove on the ground for our time.
So Tony, fantastic. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more. I want to switch over to Tony Chen. Your book, Good People, it begins with sort of examining the simple question: why? So good people, why does it matter? And what does it mean? And you sort of embark on a trip across the country, around the world, to sort of find some answers to this. So tell us why. Describe the challenge of our times that compelled you to ask that question and to find meaning in that question.
Yeah. Well, there were two things that prompted it. First off, you know, this question of good people, we all know it when we feel it. All of you can think in your circle of that type of person that makes you feel a little more confident, that is your anchor, that is your rock, that allows you to feel a higher expression of your inner self, which is a fundamental tenet of how I define leadership. Great leaders are those who can help others realize the highest inner expression of who they are towards a calling and overcome, as Nancy has written, their fears, their challenges, and to do things that they did not think was possible. So the question became, and for me it's very simple, leadership and mentorship, all these business terms that we throw on, and I'm part of the alma mater that Nancy's teaching at. We throw all these labels to make things grandiose. But my thesis is this. There are many people in this room who are great leaders. You just don't know it. Okay? Because the greatest leaders are good people. But what does that mean? What does that mean? Well, the stats, Anthony, 70% of people in the workforce today either are indifferent about their job or want to leave. 70%. And that stayed about the same in the U.S. for the last 10 years. Institutional trust. According to Edelman Barometer of Trust Against Institutions, we're at a 17-year low point across government, across media, across even NGOs, but the lowest in business. Less than 50% of people in a business institution trust their leader or their business institution to which they're working. So it prompted me to examine over 100 case studies around what does goodness really mean. And I believe that we need to redefine leadership from that standpoint of goodness. But not goodness of competency, nor goodness of confidence. We often conflate leadership as leadership of confidence. Now let's think about those people that can brag and put forth and shout. And, you know, this is really worrisome for me on that dimension, because I think a lot of the unconscious bias training we're doing between in the genders, we're almost teaching women to act more like men in some of those cases to have greater quote-unquote confidence. But there's very little correlation of leadership of confidence with actual results. Then the second one, leadership of competence. Obviously, you need a baseline of skills, okay? Obviously, you need a baseline of skills, but it's not the essence. The essence is what Nancy touched on. The greatest leadership, yes, it's defined and forged in moments of crisis, like her book says. And I've been fortuitous enough to have been placed in some situations of leadership, okay? So starting a variety of business, doing some large ones. But the heart of leadership is shaped, cultivated, through character and values. That's it. And real goodness is about that. What we need more of is leadership of character.
And competence.
And competence. But the essence and heart of it has to go down. What prepares you in those moments is your leadership of values and character. And that's my exploration. That was the 100 case studies. You can look at anyone great. And it doesn't matter. It could be, and leaders are single moms. Leaders are leaders can be found in religious movements. Leaders can be found in government. But the commonality has been great leadership of character.
I want to talk about a specific case or two, but I want to ask you about this idea of thinking about the way leaders are trained. And you mentioned the dean of the Harvard Business School, who says, we've been so long on teaching competency and skills, in short, on cultivating values and character. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I hear you talk, when I read that line, when I read that book, it seemed, I mean, that line, it seems almost obvious to me, and yet it hasn't been. Yeah.
There's two reasons. One, it's in what has traditionally been a male alpha-dominated business world, we assume that those things that are on the right side of the brain aren't as valued. We just value more the left side, the Excel spreadsheet, the concreteness of it, and these softer skills are just not viewed as valuable. I've put in plenty of case studies to show that actually the most transformative companies, and by the way, the only businesses that have lasting transformative value are those with the strongest cultures that tie back to leadership of character. But that's not what people want to believe. That's number one. Number two, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard. This is not like, you know, hey, let's just get like connect the dot and like little like, you know, Betty recipe book and say, hey, here's how you build character. It doesn't work like that. I mean, it's really hard to cultivate character. And it's a language. There's three reasons for me to write this. One is bring a language, because being good, it's hard to define, right? Explain why it's hard. And third is, what can we do about it?
So let's talk about a case in point. And you begin the book right here, the story of WD-40. You know, most of us have that blue can with the yellow writing, or is it the yellow can with the blue writing in our pantry or in our basement. I didn't know this. This turns out to be a fascinating company that has endured for a long time and in many ways represents the values that you're talking about.
Yeah, well, Gary Rich has led that company for almost 30 years, and I've come to know him through this process. And when I was looking, I said, like, let's find companies that people really love when I began this journey. Like, you know, it has to be the Facebooks. It has to be in the Valley, because I've built multiple companies out there, and surely those guys know character-led leadership and that, and it wasn't there. The turnover was high. So one of the proxies I used was like, where is it that this is my definition of engagement, that someone working there, you know, A, has retained their time there but would love to recommend it to a friend or family. They're engaged. They come to work excited each day. The top company I found was just outside of La Jolla, California, Water Displacement 40. That's what WD-40 stands for, okay? 98 to 99% engagement level. 99% of the people working there each and every year say they love working there, that they would recommend a friend or family member. And you think about what Gary does. He talks in terms of tribes and values, and he respects the families, and he knows their birthdays, and he believes in a model, which, you know, a lot of this work that Nancy and I have done go back to a lot of theses around servant-based leadership, right? Like, leadership is a duty to serve. The best leaders, as Tom Peters said, are leaders who produce other leaders, not leaders who collect followers. Your duty to serve is to help others become a higher expression of their inner self and build other leaders, and that's what WD-40 does.
So what's Gary like? I mean, describe what he's like as a person when you sit down with him and talk to him.
Well, I think like any of the 100 we took, you mentioned Nitin Nori of Harvard Business School, and we were debating this at the beginning. We said, well, you Nitin, have met many, many people in your role as dean of the business school. What differentiates somebody to great leaders? And he took a long time, and he paused. He said, you know, Tony, there's some great leaders that come in and you can't help but be starstruck. But you know the ones that really amaze you? You interact with them and within a minute you feel a little more human. They remember the humanity. And they make you feel a little bit more comfortable. They're not trying to put you in awe. They're not trying to make you feel starstruck. Like, they're trying to make you feel comfortable so they can have a conversation. And, you know, and Nancy, you've done so much work around that, too.
But what about the, and I know this is a cliche, but it's a cliche for good reason. The idea that a successful corporation begins with a kind of rigorous attention to the bottom line and making tough decisions when it's necessary. Yeah. And that might mean making decisions that are unpopular at a personnel level. I mean, how do you balance that kind of energy with what you're talking about?
Well, you know, I've decided to do two things to try to prove a point. One is, you know, I'm certain I'm the only venture capital firm in the world that started as a nail salon. I co-founded a company, Minilux, here in Boston. And there's a whole set of reasons for that. And you know, on the venture capital side, I did it because our capital markets are broken. It is an era of microwave capitalism. We do not want to build things that last forever. We tried to structure our group to say that, what if you invest in things you actually want to hold forever, so have no fun life? What's happened in the financial markets are people in a buy and sell mode. The average stock holding is in weeks now. When people invest with private venture capital company, it is like the first thing you hear in front of entrepreneurs, what's your exit strategy? I say, what the F's your entry strategy? I mean, like, your exit strategy, like, they want to know within the first 2 months. And so the challenge around that is, yes, you can do that and maniacally focus on numbers to do value capture. You'll never get great long-term value creation. Real value is a byproduct of a higher purpose. You cannot have a purpose that is to make money. A purpose, any great company, you think of any of the great companies you love, they have a higher purpose. IKEA, democratizing furniture design, right? You know, it's the Simon Sinek why. What's the essence? You know, like, great, great businesses have a very clear purpose that extends to something greater than the product. Purpose has to be bigger than product. Product has to be ahead of profit.
I really want to ask you more about the nails, the decision to invest in a nail salon. Why? I mean, talk about the sort of nature of that business, the people who essentially work in it, and who you really wanted to reach and create a life for.
Well, I'll go back to what I opened, that I believe that many people in here are leaders and mentors. And when I was 13 selling door-to-door picture frames in Toronto, there was an elderly woman who, on one of my last door knocks, stopped and said two things to me. I believe in you. I believe in you. And then she said, more important than what you do, think about who you do it with. I grew up, you know, in an immigrant family where 28 aunts and uncles were basically in the restaurant trade and retail trade, like many immigrant families are. this was an industry that was so obviously 10 years ago, long before Sarah Maslin-Nair's article in the New York Times exposed, was exploiting 400,000 largely women who are employed in this industry. It's the second largest independent workforce, working in toxic environments, carcinogenic, wearing masks, and yet all of us who have great educations and knowledge go in and we support it. And there was just a disconnect to me. So for us, the higher purpose wasn't just to have a great business and Starbucks the nail salon, that's the business side of it, but the higher purpose is to try to create a business that can offer a moment of self-care and self-love, largely to women who deserve that moment.
Hmm. There's another question, and it's a real connection between you and Nancy when I was doing the reading this morning and over the past few days. I came upon a line where you were talking about what do good leaders have in common, and one is the idea that truth begins with a mindset of humility, that is, we can learn. And I asked that question about Abraham Lincoln, the president of the United States, who realized he should have understood what he didn't know. Can you talk a little bit about that as a value?
Yeah, I think whether you call it your emotional awareness starting within, truth is the baseline of any great character-led leadership. And truth starts with humility, a willingness to know what you don't know, or at least acknowledge you may not know some of the things. Self-awareness, which is the most critical trait, so understanding your biases, because we're all biased in the way we make decisions. And ultimately, integrity. But integrity, in the way I define this type of value, is around self-congruence. And self-congruence is leadership where you actually do what you say, where you actually say what you think, where you actually think what you feel, and understand how you feel is who you are. That is the mark of great leadership and of that value serving as a foundation. If Maslow built a hierarchy of needs, it starts with truth, then it goes to compassion, which is openness, empathy, and generosity, because you have to be generous in your leadership, in your servant leadership, and ultimately it moves to highest level, defining success as a measure of wholeness, not a winner take all.
So, Tony, what's the challenge for everyone in this room? People who may not be involved in a business or sitting in a boardroom or working for a corporation. I mean, what's the sort of challenge that you would present to all of us?
The good people challenge I put forth is that, look, we throw these terms of goodness and mentorship out there, but we all have the opportunity to imprint positivity onto another. We all hold that capacity as just simply being human. You know, Colin Powell said leaders are leaders, but people are people, and that is the foundation. The greatest leaders remember that they are first and foremost a human being. So the challenge I put forth, if you can just think of 10 people in your lifetime, just 10, who you can possibly imprint some values of truth, compassion, wholeness, that can change the world, because those 10 might do it to another 10. If those 10 do it to another 10, it sounds audacious, it sounds idealistic, but every waterfall begins with a drop. That's the challenge I put forth.
I'd love to get you to talk to each other, because you've both written about qualities of great leadership. And I'm just wondering, as you listen to each other, as you've read each other's work, if you have sort of questions that you want to pose
kindred
to
spirits.
Each other. Yeah, so you're kindred spirits.
Well,
yeah.
I had read a big hunk of his book in preparation for today, but we'd never met. We didn't meet at the Harvard Business School when he was here, almost 20 years ago.
I couldn't get in our class.
No.
It was that popular.
No. But we had met. It turns out we know some people in common. It turns out that what Tony has done with his life is to say the how you build a business is everything. The how, right? And that business and that profits are a consequence, lasting value is a consequence of the purpose and the way you execute on the purpose. That's something that a number of us, not too few at the Harvard Business School, and not because we're not trying to do the right thing, but because we are a powerful institution that needs to be, adapt and change. But a number of us have been studying for a long time. I mean, I was saying to him, we sat here for half an hour and talked. We had so much in common. So I would just say that I don't really have a question for Tony so much as to say that I think that the lessons you have for anyone, right, trying to lead an enterprise, a family, a school library, a chemo infusion lab, a Senate subcommittee, anyone, right, are critically, critically important. So I'm not saying that as a historian. I'm saying as someone who has become an adult at the Harvard Business School and spent more time studying business than I have figures like Abraham Lincoln. So I think this is exceptionally important. And it comes, just last comment, it comes at a moment when, for a lot of different reasons, right, a concatenation of circumstances, as an 18th century writer might say, we're questioning for good reason the foundations and the guardrails of capitalism, right, the train tracks that global capitalism is running on. This and people like Howard Schultz, or I was just saying Walter Robb at Whole Foods, he's stepped down now, but a whole bunch of leaders around businesses are trying. What is his name at WD-40? Water displacement?
Gary Ridge. Yeah.
Gary Ridge. It comes at a moment when leaders like that, right, have more and more leg room to stand on. So I think it's exceptionally important. So this is a Valentine to Tony.
That's a good one.
I'd ask you, Nancy, the same question I asked the dean of our school, which is, you know, I've been trying to think what practically we can do to help the millennials, people that are applying to these institutions that purport to be preparing the next generation of leaders, but yet are still very biased to teaching a antiquated way.
And a left side brain way.
On the left side brain. Like, here's how I can do a better discounted cash flow. And what do you think we can do to, you know, teach more on character? You're obviously doing it at the school, and there are others there we can acknowledge, but what can we practically do more of?
Well, I'm unusual because no one comes to Harvard Business School to take history of leadership, which is what I teach. So I'm a little bit of an odd duck. But I think one thing we need to do is we need to expand our definition of what constitutes an education for a leader, and we need to include more of the humanities. The whole world needs more of the humanities, right? I'm not talking about STEM, right? That's important, but we're all the way over here. We swung as a global village to this ballast. You know, Silicon Valley is the mother lode of that, but we are not defined, and we are not made great, and we are not able to be forged in crisis and move the boulder of goodness forward without art and stories and poetry and the charting, and music. What's great? What do the humanities do? They tell us how men and women and children how the human spirit has learned to expand, right, and find its, to your point, what do great leaders do? My definition is very synonymous with you, although I stole mine from David Foster Wallace.
It's a great one.
Right? I stole it.
Remind us what it is.
Real.
I probably did. I didn't know.
Real. This is a definition he wrote in a Rolling Stone article in 2008 following the first McCain presidential campaign run. Real leaders are individuals who help us overcome the limitations of our own weaknesses and laziness and selfishness and fears, and get us to do harder, better things than we can get ourselves to do on our own. Mm-hmm. I mean, it like lines up brilliantly, right, with what you just said. It's totally in sync. So we
I
cannot.
I wish I read that before I wrote the book.
Well, you could have just stolen it too. Many of us owe debts to David Foster Wallace. But the point is, you can't be that. You can't help others be that with our smartphones and all the science and all. You know, and all the math in the world, but that's not enough. It's not nearly enough. And we can't certainly discover the compassion and empathy and kindness that are so critical to leading anything, anywhere, with that. So I would start with more humanities. I really would, including the potential of, like, the way we train divinity, leaders in the divinity, in religious. I'm not making a religious comment. It's not a comment about a sect. It's a comment about value, purpose, and the power of the human spirit and agency to align with that. So I would do something like that. Mm. And I'm biased because I'm a historian.
So, as I said, we are going to open this up to questions. So if you have questions, feel free to come up to the microphone. I've got a few more questions that I'd like to ask our authors. But when I see you up there, I'll call on you. We love getting input from the audience. So please make your way up there at any point. Nancy, just to follow up on one idea that I wanted to talk to you about. I mean, in terms of great leaders, you made the point in this book that great leaders, and you looked at leaders from a long time ago, they continue to have impact on the world today, right? I'd love you to expand on that a little bit.
So let me just say one thing with the world in a grain of sand. I'll try and be uncharacteristically brief. So I have a team of digital folks helping me market this book, because to get this word out, which I think is a word of credible inspiration and goodness out, you got to have lots of folks helping you. And these are, of course, men with facial hair, body piercings, and small dogs who live in Brooklyn. And they are brilliant. I'm going to look over my... What's your name?
Paige.
We love Paige. She's doing good service here.
Poor Paige.
And they are of Paige's ilk, and the chapter that spoke to them, The lasting legacy, was Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who many in the room don't know, a Nazi-resisting pastor who spent 7 years in his 20s and 30s resisting Hitler through an alternative church, and then in 1939 came to America to get safe because he was on the Gestapo list, ready to get arrested and possibly much worse, and then was here at Union Theological Seminary for 10 days and said, oh, my God, I can't stand it. I got to go back and be with my brethren resisting Hitler. Got on one of the last boats back to Berlin before the Second World War started, and then became a member of the resistance trying to assassinate Hitler and overthrow the government. And the story of every millennial I've spoken to that's read that story says, this is about resistance. This is about what you do when you smell authoritarian tendencies. This is about the courage you summon. This is about the kindness you summon. This is about the message that you have that is one of unity and not divisiveness. So ironically, I would never have guessed this. Without a doubt, this is the millennial legacy. You know, the man died or young, so it's astounding that that legacy lives on and has relevance and possibly, again, important motivation today.
Let's take some questions. Yes, ma'am.
This has been really interesting so far. I guess my question is for Nancy, and yet you might want to chime in too. So I spent many years doing activism on pesticide issues, and if y'all don't
And we need you right now, babe.
I'm trying. If y'all don't think pesticides affect your life, every little thing that is involved, is it? And what's so interesting to me is that although she spoke so long ago, Rachel Carson, and as you mentioned, she had breast cancer at the time, and she didn't know what her future would be like, and so Roger was a concern.
Roger was her grand-nephew that she adopted at age 50. Mm. So her story is a story about a woman working real hard, on, like all of us in this room, on lots of fronts, including caretaking. Excuse me.
So I guess from my own experiences and Rachel Carson's experience, I'd like you to comment a little bit about the, oh, you be quiet, you little lady, you. Because, I mean, I've experienced that in hearing rooms where, you know, you're hysterical, this and that. So then the next day we came in with 300 pages of studies. Yeah. You know what I mean? And so we're consistently dealing with this in any kind of hearing room, but certainly in the pesticide industry.
It's a profound question. I've not been asked it before. It's an honor to be asked it. So a couple of things. First, this is a woman in a man's world. It was science. She was working as a woman. She was trained as a scientist. She was working alone. She didn't have an institutional affiliation. And she was threatened in every which way once word got out that she was going to take on Monsanto, Dow, and the United States Department of Agriculture, who were spraying DDT and heptachlor and other pesticides in wide uses all over the country. First thing, she did her homework. Isn't that every woman's mantra? You do your homework, and then you do your homework again, and then you do it again and again, and then one more time for good measure. Right. Right. She did her homework. She understood that there isn't a truth, there's the truth.
Right.
And you work really hard, and you rigorously uncover it. She had a lot of people she reached out to double check and triple check. She had this diaspora of people that she's reaching by mostly by post and telephone in the scientific community because she'd worked. So you're not working. She was working alone in terms of what she was doing. She had the village of experts and critics, and somehow, and you know this already. So you know this. So I'm offering this. And you knew what you were going to get, so you're good at this. So I'm offering you, right? You know all this. So the last thing is, she knew that the story was incredibly important, that literally life and death, child's development, wildlife, the seas, groundwater depended on this. So when you have a purpose that's like that, you have to keep finding the dedication to get up every day and go into a room or write a page in which you know someone's going to say, shut up, ma'am, or little lady, or as they did to Elizabeth Warren in the Senate, we don't need to hear anymore. Or last but not least, as one of the agricultural USDA officials said about the book, which is all about the future as well as the moment.
It's so accurate.
It's so accurate. It's stunningly relevant. It's just stunning right here and right now. You just substitute DDT for a whole bunch of the chemicals that are being more widely used and less regulated
Roundup.
Exactly. She's, as he said, she's a spinster. What in the hell does she care about the future for?
Oh, boy.
So you have to keep finding the will to push the boulder forward.
Thank you for your comments.
God bless
you. Thank you.
Please.
One of the things that I've noticed for myself is as you sort of grow and take on more leadership responsibilities, there are moments where you need to make decisions. And I think that's really obvious sort of at our classic leaders, you know, presidents, CEOs. And you need to sort of find somewhere the ambition to say, this is a hard decision, I'm the one that's going to make it, and that I've got sort of, I'm the person who should be in the spot to make this decision. But then we talk about the need for the humility. And I'm curious what you see from the best leaders in their ability to navigate sort of that tension between the audacity to say, I'm the one here, you know, I trust myself to make this call, mm-hmm. and then doing that in a way where they don't lose sort of the humility necessary.
Yeah.
That's a great question.
It's a great question. Yeah.
I think, you know, as I said, the second part of my book explores why this is so hard, and I talk about one of the tightropes every single leader or entrepreneur walks, which is between vulnerability and conviction. And when you're thrown in that moment, I think the greatest leaders, they're emotionally self-aware, they know they need to make a decision, but a few things happen, right? So often, and in many of your stories here, they don't make the decision right away. Almost never. They reflect. Again, this is one of my concerns in the training we're doing against unconscious bias training, because we say that, hey, typically men in meetings will go and give that answer first. Well, Daniel Kahneman and others have said that, you know, your first answer is often your worst answer. So first, they take the time to pause. And they're self-aware. They recognize leadership is extraordinarily lonely. But when they present out their decision, they understand that they need to pull people together. They do it in a human way. I think there's great power, as Breen Brown and others have said, to use your vulnerability as power. To say, sometimes it's okay, I don't know all the answers, but this is what we need to do. And when you connect at that human-to-human level, incredible things can happen. But you're always balancing this vulnerability and conviction. You want to show a level of surety, but not arrogance in your decision making. And I think it's a tough balance.
I love how many intersections there are with these two books, because one of the questions I wanted to ask you about was from the section of Lincoln. You make the section on Lincoln. You remind us that sometimes great leadership means the ability to do nothing at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wrote that in the preface in the short intro. Like, sometimes the most powerful something that we can do as leaders is to do nothing. Right? And the way I tell it, there's a number of examples in Lincoln. All the people in the book learn this, right? The higher the stakes, the hotter you are emotionally under the collar, the better it is, because you're not going to make your best decision in that moment, and the stakes matter because they're high, is to actually do nothing in the heat of the moment. Do nothing. The classic example, which I need to tell you in relation to this moment in history, is after the Battle of Gettysburg, which, as you all know, the Union won under the command of a newly appointed General George Meade. After the battle, George Meade makes a decision, July 3rd, not to pursue Lee, Robert E. Lee's retreating army that was kind of limping back to Virginia, because his men are too tired, right? 50,000 casualties in those 3 days, combined casualties on both sides. And Lincoln gets wind of Meade's decision, which he makes for good reasons. And Lincoln is just absolutely beside himself with anger and frustration. And I see him. I know Mr. Lincoln. I've spent a long time with him. I say that. It's not an audacious statement. I've been with him 15 years. I really know him. And I didn't write a book about him, which is just as important. And right? It's very important. And he I can see it. He starts gathering speed. You can Google the letter. It's every single letter he ever wrote is digitized. It's in the Library of Congress online. Just to get Google Lincoln to Meade. And he writes this letter and gets going, starts building up a head of steam. You have no idea, General Meade, how disappointed I am. You have prolonged the war and definitely costing thousands of lives. He gets going. Think of all our emails. And then he closes graciously. It's Lincoln. And then I see him pausing, stepping back, taking a yoga breath, and folding up the letter and putting it in his desk where it's found after he died to George Meade, General George Meade, never signed, never sent. And here's what he realized when he stopped, paused, when he did nothing. He realized He was out of generals. He'd fired McClellan, brought him back, fired McClellan, brought him back. The West Point brass thought he was, you know, a meddling, incompetent commander-in-chief. Grant and Sherman hadn't yet emerged from the West to be the generals he needed to prosecute this war. He's got nobody. So he couldn't afford to alienate me. So he folds the letter up. I say to executives who I coach on their relationship with their lovers, I say, what if Lincoln had email and hit send? The course of world history might have been different. This is a lesson for our president and lots of us today. Sometimes doing nothing is the most powerful act of leadership, an act of forbearance that one can offer.
Let me just give a corollary to that that's very practical that I learned from one of my most loved mentors that my wife knows, Jay Chiat, who founded TBWA Chiat Day and died at 70 years too young from cancer. But it's this. Next time someone brings you an idea, what Jay had was an unbelievable capacity to listen to ideas. Next time someone brings you an idea, can you wait 24 seconds before making a comment? If you can wait 24 seconds, might you be able to wait 24 minutes to think about it? And if you can wait 24 minutes, I've written a 24-by-3 rule. If you can wait 24 minutes, can you wait 24 hours to think about every single reason why the idea might work before you allow yourself to think about why it shouldn't work? You know, you will never, I'm in the business of trying to foster innovation and change. And I can tell you when, you know, I was at a partnership before, I launched my own firm, Q-Ball and Minilux, and I remember one meeting where, you know, 14 of the very senior white male partner men were saying, how do we get more women here or be partners? Oh, we must need more flex time, you know? And it's like idiots wrapped in morons making comments around this. And I said, you know, maybe it would be helpful to have a woman here. But let's take that aside. You know, when I said I was going to retire to launch a nail salon, how many of do you think waited 24 seconds? It was like minus 2.4 seconds. Like, you're an idiot. Like, they thought it was a joke, first of all. But, you know, no great change. If you look at the greatest innovations that we have, I don't think there are people that just like, you know, wisdom is a double-edged sword, right? Like, you know, you want to be cautious and give pause and listen. There's lots of great ideas, 24-by-3.
It's such a great idea. I've thought about this a lot in journalistic organizations that I've worked for, and I'm certainly not picking on the one that I'm working for now, so don't take this in any way, but I have noticed that it feels like it's much easier to say no, to dismiss an idea. Why is that? Is it just because then we don't have to do any deep thinking?
I think it's human nature. I think it was Oscar Wilde who said, you know, a cynic is someone that knows the price of everything and the value of nothing.
Yeah.
And I think it's just so easy to quickly respond. It's how we're wired.
And we're living in a very transactional.
Yeah, super.
Exceptionally transactional moment, right? Mm-hmm. That in which pace is now, and our reactivity is driving so much of what's happening at the very top of our national governance. Yeah. So I think all those things combined get us into this, like, show me, gotcha, right? Show me no.
Absolutely.
Show me no now.
Yeah.
Or 5 minutes ago or, you know, 5 hours ago.
It's a I win generation. I want it now.
Right.
It's a fail fast generation. And I say, what about failing slowly if you're trying to build something good? I mean,
that endures. That's worthy.
Endures. Build enduring, meaningful value.
Mm. Yep. Sir, please.
Thank you. You've hinted at a quality, but I'd like to hit it directly, which is the ability of a leader to see multiple viewpoints on a particular issue, to be able to multidimensionalize an issue. Because in these times, especially, it seems like we're in scarce. I mean, that's a quality we need. I like to say I'm not 100% certain of anything. I still need to take action as a leader. We have to be decisive. But we also have to decide with humility, knowing that we actually don't know everything about what we're talking about.
So I'll try to make it brief. So I couldn't agree with you more. And all these people learn, right, to detach themselves from the immediacy of the moment well enough to do. What's your name, sir?
John.
To just walk around it and look at an issue, and then, including, by the way, sometimes themselves in the issue, right, in the moment, almost like a theater in the round, right, or Michelangelo's statue, the David in the academia, where you can still walk around and look at, you know, look at that amazing piece of work, piece of art, to do that. And the other thing that I think is important, I'm curious to hear what Tony has to say about this, because he knows about, more about this than I do, and in today's leaders, empathy, right? They somehow, I think partly because of crisis and the humility that comes with empathy, have reserves, right, of empathy that allow you to really put yourself or walk in someone else's shoes, and that helps you a lot seeing the issue, like from another person's point of view, even your opponent's point of view, your enemy's point of view. So I think both those qualities, they're related. The ability to detach oneself, and this is actually much easier than it sounds. You coach people to do this really easily, right? And the ability to summon up a sense of what the other person is living with or experiencing or wanting is very important.
I think it's spot on. So first, I mean, it's well known that, you know, going back to Lincoln, he had a diversity of excellence in his cabinet. And I think, you know, what we've tried to do in my own firm is we're half women in an investment firm. We're amongst the most diverse. My business partner, who led the transformation of Thompson, 47,000 people, to turn it from a newspaper company to become worth $40 billion over 10 years, was a plumber that took 9 years to get out of school. And I look at the support they continue to give to Everett and West Roxbury, where they grew up, one of the most humble people. But I look at the diversity of people. He took a bet on a Newfoundlander kid to come in and work side by side with him. I'm also the only venture firm that has two Newfoundland partners, two Newfie partners. But I think that the empathy point, I was telling Nancy this story early on, when I started with my partners, Mini Lux and Nail Salon, we have 30 businesses now, but this is a core position for us. I thought, like many men, this is just a trivial moment of beauty. This is just like, whatever, we'll go do it. I knew there was something more, but I didn't really get it. And there was one day I went in, and I saw a woman in her 40s there, and she was visibly not comfortable getting a manicure. So I went up and I said, "Hi, I'm Tony Chen. I'm the co-founder. I'm chairman. Like, how are you? Yada, yada." She goes, "I'm fine." And I said, "You know, is everything okay?" "It's my first time getting a manicure." "Really? It's your first mani?" And then you see her start to almost break down. And she goes, "You know what? I'm a single mom. I have a job interview today. I came in just for a little boost of self-confidence. Thank you." Now, that just reframes how you think about the purpose of a business. That moment allows you to transport yourself wholly into the shoes of another, to understand that you have a higher calling and purpose. And I think that those things only come from diversity of the people around you, bringing the humanity back, and stepping in and having the mindset of a merchant and walking anthropologically to try to understand the viewpoint from the other side.
Tony, that's a beautiful story. I have sort of a follow-up that I'm really interested in asking you, and that is, you know, we started this conversation talking about the huge lack of confidence in terms of people's belief in these institutions. Since you've completed this project, are you optimistic that things are going, that things can change and that confidence can shift?
Yeah, I'm Chinese, so we have a long view, you know, of the world. And, you know, things, you know, tend to change in 4-year or 2-year periods. So eventually things will change. So I think, you know, we tend to overestimate, as you know, this is a Metcalfe law in technology, we tend to overemphasize and overestimate the short term and way underestimate the long term. So I am not without a sense of disappointment and fear of some of the long-lasting repercussions of what's happening at this moment. But I'm equally filled with great optimism. I see the pages, the millennials out there. I get to work with people each and every single day. I get to work with, in just one of my businesses, 700 women who were viewed the bottom of a totem pole in a vocational trade, who say, "Look, I have a sense of independence, development, care. I view myself as artisanal. I view myself as a nail designer." And I see them, like, becoming a breadwinner. I see this in my business. I have to be optimistic. I have to deploy the 24/3 rule because that's what I'm doing. I am funding human capital and future optimism. That's what I do. So otherwise, you know, I don't have a business.
May I say something, too?
Please.
You know, I live half my day in the past and half my day in the present. I'm optimistic because I think crises call forth leaders from the mists.
Yeah.
So no one had ever heard of Abraham Lincoln except the few people in central Illinois in 1854. Right, no one had ever heard of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Very few people heard of Rachel Carson, certainly in 1950. So these people, crises call for, there's a whole bunch of people we haven't come out of the mist yet. A lot of young people, we see a lot of interesting leaders, new leaders that don't look anything like current leaders running for Congress next year. So I'm optimistic, but I think we have a job to do as citizens. And if you'll just permit me two sentences. We've been seduced a little bit. You were saying this earlier, so were you, Anthony, by leadership bling, by the idea that charisma and hard-driving aggression and how fast someone got rich are good qualities to base a candidacy or to entrust our governance on. We got to get much more demanding, folks, and much more discriminating. We got to start asking the hard stuff of people who want to take the public trust. They got to earn it, and we got to ask things like, "What did you do in adversity?" We got to get at their character. We got to get at their competence. We got to stop being seduced by the bright, shiny objects of who's walking on the red carpet thinking that's going to help the public interest move forward when these people are elected.
Hear, hear. So we have time for one more question.
Okay. Well, I was an English major at Harvard Business School. 35 years ago, I went to my reunion last weekend, and it was a very brutal, competitive time, force curve. People were just hoping other people would flunk so that they would survive. I had two people in my section who kind of stood out as people who tried to bring us up. And no matter what you think of them these days, these two people were Jamie Dimon, CEO of JPMorgan Chase, and Steve Burke, CEO of NBC Universal.
Fascinating.
So that's my comment. My question is, these days, who in the political world, not the WD-40 guys, the business world, but for the rest of us, the English majors from Harvard Business School, the English majors in this room, who in the political world do you think are able to move that boulder of goodness forward now?
Do you respect? Do you want me to respond?
I'll
just say three people, one of whom's not running for office, not yet in office. So let's forget about John Lewis, who's been moving the boulder of goodness forward for a long time. You don't know who he is. You go look at him. Okay, we forget, right? He had never stopped. Kept on keeping on. Now, his story is really, we're due for a documentary about Mr. John Lewis. Secondly, Seth Moulton, who's...
Yes.
Sorry. There's a man who's digging deep to find his anchors of moral courage and trying to figure out the world, because he understands how important this moment is. Everything is up for grabs. And third, I want you all to go home and Google Amy McGrath. You know, right? She's running for Congress in Kentucky against a Mitch McConnell protege. She was the first woman to fly, I don't remember the name of the fighter plane, and she's flown more missions, more dangerous missions than like any pilot in the U.S. Air Force. She was raised by a single mother, who I think was an esthetician. And she has, I think, three kids. She's from rural Kentucky, and she is the future, just like Paige. Wow. So you need to go pay attention to her. Okay? Amy McGrath, just like it sounds.
I'll say one thing as a political journalist. If you're talking about sort of emerging presidential leadership, 3 years before 2008, I would doubt that anyone in this room knew who Barack Obama was.
Yeah.
So, one of the things that I've observed in the reporting I've done just across Massachusetts in the wake of the last election is political organizing that's happening on a grassroots level that hasn't happened in a long, long time. So I don't know who the people are. I mean, I know their names. Seth Moulton's a great name. There are other people out there. But I think by the time we get to 2012 or 2011 or maybe 2010 and a half, there are going to be some other names out there that we're going to be all very excited about. That's my feeling. Okay. Tony, I want to give you the sort of the last word because I think our time is 1 minute to go.
I just say that thank you very much to Nancy, to Anthony, to the Boston Book Festival, a great organization that allows us to convene like this on not-for-profit, and you're all good people. Go out and be mentor-led.
Dear Tony!
Thank you.
Well,
thank you all. That's really fun.
That's really fun.
Thank you.
I really appreciate that.